Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Senior military officials and analysts have said for some time that climate change poses national security risks. Sea level rise and extreme weather are threats to military infrastructure, and droughts and floods exacerbated by climate change can fuel unrest and conflict that might engage our military. So it's perhaps ironic that the armed forces are a massive consumer of fossil fuels and a source of greenhouse gas emissions. If the Department of Defense were a country, it would be the 55th largest emitter globally. But it could be worse. DoD has made huge strides in reducing its carbon footprint, cutting emissions by almost a third in just 13 years. Still, there's more work to be done. And my next guest says there's a case to be made for decarbonizing the military. Nita Crawford is co-director of the Costs of War Project based at the Watson Institute at Brown University. She is a professor of political science at Boston University and a board member of the Council for a Livable World. She's written about the carbon footprint of the military for theconversation.com. Nita, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
So, Nita, the Department of Defense is the world's largest consumer of oil. Where does it all go?
Well, much of it goes to operations, that is, flying things about. Jet fuel is the largest element of the consumption of the fossil fuels. But there's also diesel used to power installations, liquid propane gas, natural gas. They use, even today, coal.
And you mentioned fueling airplanes being the largest chunk of that. I mean, the mileage of a military jet is pretty abysmal.
Right. They get on the order of gallons per mile. So let's say a B-2.
Not miles per gallon, gallons per mile.
Right. Gallons per mile. Hard to wrap your head around. So they get about 4.2 gallons per mile. That is a B-2. And let's say the latest F-35 fighter bomber is much better, only consuming 2.3 gallons per mile. But as you can see, that's not a great fuel economy rate, no matter how you look at it.
When we're talking about the carbon footprint of the military, how much of that is going to actively fighting wars, being engaged in conflicts, and how much of it is just flying planes and driving vehicles around, perhaps to be prepared or just as training in the normal operations of the military?
Okay, so the Department of Defense thinks about it as installations and bases, and that's about 30% of the fuel usage. And then there's what they call the operational usage, and that's 70%. So that is war-related.
Well, Nita Crawford, you've released a new analysis of fuel consumption and the resulting greenhouse gas emissions from 1975 through 2017. Let's start with the most recent numbers. The military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases in 2017. I mean, obviously, that's a big number. What is that like in terms of the number of cars on the road or something we might be able to wrap our heads around?
Oh, I think it's 247 million cars or something like that. I actually don't have that number at the tip of my tongue. It's so large.
Going over time, I mean, how has that number changed? While we said 59 million metric tons is a really large number, that has fluctuated over time.
That's right. In 1975, the first year for which I had records, the total emissions were 109 million metric tons. So they've dramatically decreased. Of course, there's been fluctuation. So when the military is at war, or at a high level of mobilization, let's say in preparation to war or drawing down from war, their consumption goes up. So it was up, for instance, in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, when the United States was at a peak of fighting. And then it went up again in the period when the United States surged in Iraq and then later in Afghanistan. But as the U.S. military draws down its military activities and reduces forces in a region, the consumption has gone down. But there's also been, part of the explanation of the dramatic decrease is a decreased use of coal and fuel oil at installations. That's a big part of the story.
You also note that a big part of the story is the fact that of the operations that the military is conducting at any given time, a lot of effort and therefore fuel goes to this kind of circular act of defending our oil interests and our access to foreign oil. Were you able to drill in and figure out if that particular usage has increased or decreased over time?
Well, the way to understand that is thinking about 1979 as the point when the United States turned to using a great deal of its resources to defend access to Persian Gulf oil and to protect interest in that region. And that's because after the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and there was the Iranian hostage crisis, the United States feared that some power could try to control the Persian Gulf. And then over time, the United States has changed the name of the mission. The mission itself really hasn't changed. But at the same time, the U.S. has got a more diverse source of petroleum oil, in that the United States' own production of petroleum has increased and it gets more petroleum resources from Canada and elsewhere. And the United States' use of renewable energies has increased, so the overall need for Persian Gulf oil has decreased. But there's been no rethink of the mission.
Nita Crawford, the piece that you wrote for TheConversation.com is in large part making the case for decarbonizing the military. And you point out that, of course, if we reduced the military's reliance on oil, that would reduce the need to use fuel, to use oil and create greenhouse gases, defending access to oil. So there's kind of, you know, that circle could feed in the other direction if we were to reduce the fossil fuel reliance of the military. What are some of the other arguments for decarbonizing the military beyond just the broader consensus that, you know, we need to reduce emissions from everything in order to limit climate change?
Well, one reason is the one that the Pentagon gives for decreasing their own fossil fuel consumption. The United States is vulnerable when it has to transport fuel, let's say, into a war zone. And in fact, that's been a military goal since the early 2000s, to cut the tether to fuel, as Jim Mattis said. The point was to make the United States military and everybody who's transporting that fuel less vulnerable because we need less of it. But another reason is simply that it's time to rethink all of these missions and bases for three reasons. One, some of them are already vulnerable and, in fact, inundated because of climate change.
Inundated, you mean literally with water?
That's correct. They're regularly, tides wash over and through bases. And then, of course, Norfolk Naval Base is sinking relative to sea level. And there are other bases which are experiencing extreme heat. The installation that the Navy has in the Arctic is vulnerable because of the permafrost melting. The buildings are literally shifting. There are many reasons why the installations are vulnerable, and the DoD has done a study of this and said that 77, I think, are right now experiencing or will soon experience difficulties because of climate change-related conditions.
So that might argue, what, for doing away with them altogether, relocating them? What's the thought there?
There's the necessity for base realignment and closure because the U.S. military has more bases, in fact, probably than it needs.
Something we here on Cape Cod are intimately familiar with, yes.
Right. Another reason to look at this is that some of these installations and bases, which are not necessary any longer or vulnerable, could be converted to other uses. For example, they could be places where the United States invests instead in renewable energy, which is actually a much better producer of jobs than military spending. So military spending produces something like 9 jobs directly and indirectly per $1 million spent. But if you look at alternative or clean energy, that is a greater producer, as well as solar. Those produce almost twice as many jobs per $1 million spent. So if we're talking not millions, but billions, you can see that this would be a great boost to the economy. In addition, those bases and installations could be converted to places where there's reforestation, which would sequester carbon. There's a number of reasons, in fact, that we need to rethink the bases.
So are you suggesting we should be redirecting military funding to address climate change?
I'm suggesting that we rethink the U.S. military budget and line it up with actual threats. Climate change is a real threat. It's urgent. It started by changing the profile of the missions and the use of U.S. resources, military resources. We could both diminish the risks that we fear from climate change, including climate war, and actually reduce the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, or even engage in sequestration at these converted military bases. There are lots of opportunities here.
Nita Crawford, you've studied the military for a large chunk of your career and have been looking at specifically of late the carbon footprint of the military. As you've said, military officials, high-ranking military officials, recognize the national security risks and the threats directly to our military installations that climate change does pose. And they've said that they do need to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels. You've made the argument that the military needs to decarbonize. What does that mean in your mind? Are you talking about a zero carbon military? And how much further does your idea of what the military needs to do go than what military officials have committed to?
Well, the military has actually separated the two issues of reducing fossil fuel consumption for those operational reasons that I discussed. And they've put in a different category altogether the threat of climate change. They act as if climate change related inundation or their bases and challenges to operations and even climate war are almost a fait accompli without recognizing their own contribution. So the first step would be for them to put the two things together and then develop a list of priorities for reductions in emissions. I don't know how they could go to zero. That would mean really changing a lot about their fuel consumption. They're even looking, in fact, into alternative jet fuels that are biofuels. All of those things are possible, but we must relate missions and risks and vulnerabilities. They can't be separate.
That's Nita Crawford. She's co-director of the Costs of War Project based at the Watson Institute at Brown University, a professor of political science at Boston University, and a board member of the Council for a Livable World. You can find her writing about the carbon footprint of the military on theconversation.com. Nita, thanks.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.